Hi everybody, I'm Jason Scorce and welcome to another episode of Dispatch from the Zombie Apocalypse. Hope everybody's doing great. Really excited for today's conversation, which is going to be the beginning of a two-part series on plant-based diets and the plant-based industry and the larger movement to help people all over the country and the world transition to a plant-based diet. And today I have the CEO of Plant-Based Solutions, David Benzikin, as my interviewee. David is an investor in a lot of new up-and-coming plant-based companies, which he will talk to you about in just a few moments. And he's also a consultant and does marketing for plant-based companies. And before we get into the substance of today's conversation, I just want to lay out a few key points here to set the table, so to speak. The first is, just on a personal note, I have been vegan, a herbivore, full 100% plant-based diet for almost 24 years, and vegetarian for almost 30 years. And it's the single best thing I've ever done in terms of a lifestyle decision, a way of life decision. I can't really explain all the benefits in a few minutes here in the podcast, but it really has been an incredible positive influence in my life. But putting aside the personal health aspects, which are incredibly important, obviously, as someone who studies environmental policy and global energy use and greenhouse gases, the animal industry is really the worst offender on just about every dimension. A lot of this is probably known to many of you out there. I don't want to bore you with tons of facts and figures. I will happily provide anybody who emails me with plenty of resources and information to look all this stuff up. But the bottom line here that I want to confer is that while the biggest thing we're doing for the planet right now is transitioning off of fossil fuels, the second biggest thing, which gets less attention, but which is really just as important, and if in some sense maybe more so, is to transition human beings away from a heavy animal-based diet to a plant-based diet. And let me get a few facts and just kind of key points out of the way here. The first is, I'm not saying everybody needs to be 100% vegan, and I'm not preaching anything here. The beauty of this first part of the information here is that it's just math. So the reality is that when you feed plants to animals, you waste about 90% of the energy and water that went into the plants to keep the animal alive, and then we kill the animal and eat that or take its milk or eggs or whatever. And so it's just hugely inefficient. So the UN is projecting by the end of the century, the world population is going to top out at about 10 billion people. So that's about 3 billion more than we have now. And then also people are going to be, in general, wealthier if you know, we don't destroy the planet first or have World War III. So that means 10 billion relatively middle class / affluent consumers. The math is simple. 10 billion humans eating animal products as their main form of calories and protein is unsustainable. We could go 100% renewable and we could have off of fossil fuels, but if we are eating animals at the levels that we are, we're still going to have an unsustainable planet. And so this just has to be part of the larger movement. And the two other dimensions I just want to add to this are that it's also just incredibly, incredibly wasteful in terms of resources, in terms of taking up land mass, because that 10 to 1 inefficiency is also with respect to land mass. That means much of the world's deforestation is due in some level to animal production. And the waste that animals produce is just really staggering. There's photos, which if you just Google around, you'll find, of these mountains of manure. Mountains. It literally looks like a mountain range, but it's actually the waste from animals. And most of this ends up in our waterways and our groundwater and in the oceans. And it's just devastating. The toxicity is just incredible. The one thing I'll point out, which is just stunning, and again, you can look this up, I am not exaggerating here, is in North Carolina, is where most of the pork in the US is produced, and they have these huge ponds of the feces, the liquid feces from pigs. And what they do to get rid of it, this is no joke, is that they spray it in mist across fields, and much of this blows onto people's property and land. And of course, these are the poor people because they're always the ones that get screwed. So there are poor communities in North Carolina where literally liquid shit is being missprayed on their property and on their land, and they literally have to have their windows closed and they cannot go outside because they're being sprayed with shit pretty much 24/7. And this brings me to the final point in the lead up to this, which is as much as we can go on the pure kind of efficiency and environmental resources angle, which is incredibly important. The reality is that the animal industrial complex is probably the single most brutal, inhumane, and despicable industry in the world today. And I want to be clear, this is not just the treatment of animals. The people who are working in slaughterhouses, many of them are immigrants or the lowest paid workers in the world, and they are incredibly abused, and their conditions are just almost hell on earth. And the injuries and the kind of the repetitive motions of killing animals all day and being in the blood and the feces and the cuts and injuries they get and the bacteria they're exposed to. This is just horrific. I will say with 99.99% certainty that if any of my listeners were to spend a day in a major slaughterhouse in the US or anywhere around the world, that you would never eat products from those places ever again, that your conscience would be so shocked that you wouldn't be able to support those industries. And the reality is that the only way we can support those is by not thinking about it and not seeing it. And in fact, there's laws now against people taking videos and even taking pictures from the roads of these slaughterhouses and of these huge animal operations, because they know once people see it, it's just that it's too much of a shock to the conscience. So let me end this by saying I'm not here to preach, I'm here to just talk facts, but these are facts. Everything I've just said is an unassailable fact. And I used to be kind of a militant vegetarian vegan, and I'm not that way anymore. My overarching goal is to just turn people on to great plant-based foods and help people make the transition and in whatever way is comfortable for them and whatever time frame for them. And those who choose not to, that's your business. You have the freedom to do good, and you have the freedom to not do good. And you have the freedom to treat the planet how you want or not. The only thing I would point out on that fact is, if we treated our pets as we treated farm animals who are as or more sentient than our pets, we would be put in jail. And so there's just this crazy reality that we can treat a pig or a cow the way that would get us locked up hard time to treat a cat or a dog. And so that just doesn't make any sense. And so for those of you out there who are not on this path, but have a good conscience and are understanding what I'm saying has some ring of truth to it, I want to just tell you, I understand it's hard to think like this. It's hard to realize that the things you're doing are contributing to these great ills in the world. And I'm not here to judge you. I'm here to just provide information and to make an assist. that, hey, you know, if you want to start making a transition, there's a lot of great resources out there. And the beautiful thing is that I also want to just end this point on is that we can have our cake and eat it too now. There's just so many amazing products that you can really have, you know, having a plant-based diet is not an act of desperation or deprivation. It's actually an amazing culinary adventure that is awaiting you. And so this is all good. It's all for the good. We can have our cake and eat it too. We can be healthy and strong and have an incredible gourmet diet, but contribute to, you know, a sustainable planet and not, you know, promote the torture and cruelty of humans and animals. So that, I want to end on that good note. So I'm going to switch now to the interview with David. So David Benzikin, again, is the CEO of Plant-Based Solutions. He is a real inspiring figure and a leader in the plant-based movement. I'm going to put a little music here, transition, and then we'll get David on. So I hope you enjoy. Everybody, I'm here with David Benzikin, who is a plant-based vegan entrepreneur and is the CEO of Plant-Based Solutions in New York City. And I've been talking with David the last couple months of some ideas that I've been floating around. But with this interview, I really want to get his views on the movement and his businesses and where all this is going. Because as I've mentioned on this podcast before, I think plant-based is the future of food and the future of a sustainable human society. So David, thanks so much for joining the podcast. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent, excellent. So let's just dive in on the kind of motivations, because I think it's good to set the table here, so to speak. You know, many people ask me my motivations for being vegan, and I'm an all of the above person. There's not one thing, health or the environment or animal rights, that really motivates me. I think it's the full suite. But I'm curious, what motivates you? Do you have a story? What got you into this movement and this lifestyle?
Sure. So the first thing that really got me into it was thinking about the welfare of animals and understanding that, you know, I loved animals in my life and those that I saw around me. I always wish I had a dog and all these things. But when it came to how we treat farm animals, I realized that it just didn't match how I thought about animals in general. So the first thing was around animals. But very quickly, my health changed dramatically after going vegan, and I learned a lot more about the incredible environmental impacts. And the bottom line is, no matter why somebody's doing it, I just think it's a beautiful thing that without having to convince the rest of the world to do anything, without having to pass a law or change a corporate policy or anything else, you can make a choice every single time you're at the grocery store, every single time you sit down to eat, that can help improve your health, save animals, and improve the planet.
Yeah, no, I really want to zero in on that. There's just something incredibly empowering about diet, because it's like you said, it doesn't require any coercion, right? It's just us every day going about our lives. And you know, it's something that really the grassroots is leading it in a lot of ways. It doesn't have to be a top down. So I can really relate to that. You know, thinking about it more broadly in terms of expanding the reach, and in some sense that is already happening, because I really do think we're at an inflection point where it's just about to go exponential here. But still, you know, it's still a tiny percentage in most countries, and there's a lot of room to grow. And so, given that you're in the industry and you're really talking with a lot of leaders, do you think there's any particular angle in terms of getting the kind of a more mass awareness of that that's more salient than others? For example, most people say, well, people care about personal health. You know, that's a way to get through to them. You know, obviously you got through there on animal rights. But are there certain types of messages that you think resonate the most with the general public?
I think the research shows that health is one of the biggest motivating factors. But more importantly, I think the most salient thing, the thing that we need to focus on, is being respectful, being approachable, showing how easy, delicious, affordable, convenient, and just fun this lifestyle is. And being supportive and encouraging of every step people take, rather than demanding things and putting pressure to be a certain way or expecting, you know, 100% transformation overnight. You know, every single time somebody makes a choice to, you know, switch out one item in a single meal or once a week or whatever else, it's making a difference. And just like if I always tell people, if, you know, if you were quitting smoking and you slipped up and you have a cigarette, somebody who says to you, you know, oh, you might as well go back to smoking a pack a day would be a schmuck. And it's kind of the same thing here. We've got to respect people. We've got to understand that none of us are perfect. We're doing a lot of different things in our lives. You know, I'd like to say that I'm totally sweatshop free. It's not that easy, convenient, or affordable to buy exclusively sweatshop free clothes. So I'm not perfect. And that doesn't mean I don't care. And a lot of people care. We need to encourage them and support them and show them how delicious and wonderful it is. And that's the bottom line. The salient thing is making it easy, accessible, affordable, and fun. And if we do that, we're going to be effective. You mentioned that the percentages are small. That's true if you look at the percentage of people who identify by and use the phrase vegan or who eat exclusively that way. But much more impressively and more importantly, when you look at the numbers of people who are heading in this direction, you know, over 17% of the country, as of 3 or 4 years ago, over 17% of the country in the U.S. says that they eat more than half their meals vegetarian. Over 40% say that they've had animal, you know, animal protein analogs in the last month. Over 60% say they're trying to reduce their animal protein intake and that they want to keep it that way and that they're doing it for various reasons. So while it's true that a small percentage of the population is vegan, that is really not the marker of success. The marker of success is that we're quintupling, sextupling, exponentially growing the number of people who are moving towards a more plant-based diet and moving towards a dietary and lifestyle, a diet and lifestyle that is saving animals and health and the planet.
Yeah, and I think you made two excellent points there. First, just those stats, you know, you're exactly right that the kind of the farthest end of the spectrum is small, but I'm actually surprised that it's that high on the people even who are conscious of these kind of terminology and so that they can reflect that in a survey that they're actually making a move. And so that's really encouraging. And then your notion about making it fun and easy, it just seemed, you know, I will admit, I will cop to being kind of a militant vegan when I started 25 years ago and probably not being the nicest person to be around with. And so for anyone who remembers that, I apologize. But what you just said about, you know, that's absolutely reflects my current thing, which is just turn people on to awesome food. It's not a deprivation mindset, right? It's a celebration mindset. And that's the best way to get people to see, right? It's just that it's fun. It's not giving something up. It's not a sacrifice. So I'm glad you emphasized that. So speaking of fun and new, tell us about some of the companies you're working with and the things you're excited about in the plant-based world. You know, there's a lot going on. I'm curious to get your finger on the pulse kind of diagnosis here.
Sure. So one company that we've been really honored to work with is a company that we've helped launch and that we run with the founder. The company is called Ocean Hugger Foods, and it's a company that's really tackling the issue of unsustainable seafood, which is one area that has really not been addressed sufficiently by the plant-based movement. And there are very few companies that are looking at alternatives to seafood. And so this company was founded by a certified master chef, just an extraordinary guy and a really talented chef named James Corwell. And Jimmy, as I call him, Jimmy has developed several extraordinary products that replace, you know, ahi tuna for sushi or for poke, salmon that you would eat smoked or raw, eel that you would eat in sushi, all these different products using really simple, clean whole foods ingredients like tomatoes, carrots, and eggplant. And they have incredible texture, incredible mouthfeel and taste. And we are so proud to work on this issue because nobody's talking about it, because no matter how people feel about the idea of being vegan, everybody can agree that the near extinction of tuna is a disaster, that our oceans are in serious peril. when the New York Times is reporting that by 2050 there will be zero fish in the sea, we know that we have a serious crisis on our hands, and we're proud to be part of working to replace to fix that. So that's one company that I'm very honored to work on. The company's called Ocean Hugger Foods, and you'll be able to find our products nationwide very soon. In fact, tomorrow, I don't know what day this will be airing, but on July 29th, 2017, we're going to be launching nationwide on an online retailer. Please go to our Twitter page and Facebook page and find out more about how you can order it yourself to have it in your own home. Sorry for that plug.
Please plug away.
And we'll be in retailers and restaurants nationwide very soon. Actually, beyond the U.S., U.S. and Canada very soon. But that's one business we're really excited to be working with. We're also working with a company that is one of the most historic and long-time brands in the plant-based space, called Moosewood. Many people will remember that in the 70s, the Moosewood cookbook was, and still is, really the Bible of vegetarian or plant-based cooking. And today they are expanding their business, and we are very proud to be collaborating with them to help bring that business to the next level, bring this, heritage brand, which has really defined the plant-based space for so many years, and helping get it into everybody's hands beyond the restaurant that is their flagship in Ithaca and the cookbooks that they have won so many awards for over the years. So we're working on that as well, and just a lot of very exciting projects.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, I remember Moosewood very well. My brother actually went to Cornell, so I remember visiting them up there and going to their restaurant, and that was a high point for me. I'm really glad you also mentioned the plant-based substitutes for seafood and fish, because we haven't spent that much time getting acquainted, but that's my day job, is basically working in marine policy, and I've had major debates, auditoriums full debating the sustainable seafood movement, which I think is highly flawed to be charitable. And so to see people really taking that head on, and seafood is a tough one. I think it's probably easier just in terms of texture and stuff to kind of do the veggie burger, whatever, versus a tuna. So I think it's just amazing. And I didn't know your product was going to be available, so quickly. I'm going to order some and have a little dinner party here. So I'll report back on how that goes. So moving forward here, maybe this is a kind of a two-part question, which is what kind of structural obstacles do you think remain that are maybe preventing the increased and kind of more rapid adoption of plant-based foods in society? And then the kind of part two is that, obviously the animal-based industry, I think, is trying to figure out what to do. They're doing a two-pronged approach, which is buying up companies and making investments of their own, but also doing what, you would expect the kind of a tobacco type industry to do, which is fight back and fight back dirty. So that's one obstacle on some level but I'm just kind of curious to get your take on both the kind of structural issues and then the response of the animal-based industries.
Yep. So I think that, when the plant-based industry first started picking up steam, we did see some reaction from the traditional food industry, but I think that's really changed in terms of a negative light. What you're seeing now is that they really understand that the future of food is about authenticity, sustainability, health, and animal welfare, and all these things. And really, the largest food companies, who for years were reticent to change their ways, they're seeing that this is what consumers want. And I genuinely believe that what they're looking for is how they can offer what consumers want. They're looking to, they don't have an inherent interest specific, the food companies. I can't speak for the large producers of these animal ingredients, but certainly the food companies, they're thinking about how they can make money. They're thinking about how they can employ people, how they can make money. And for years, that has been in using animal products. But as they see that changing, they're changing as well. And the largest food companies in the world are now making investments in plant-based products. Just yesterday, a massive Japanese company with dozens and dozens and dozens of subsidiaries, including in food and pharmaceuticals and other things, purchased Daya Foods, Pinnacle Foods, which owns Duncan Hines and all these very traditional food companies, bought Gardein and some other fantastic plant-based brands. You're really seeing a change in tone and a change in strategy, where they're seeing that the future is this. I mean, even Cargill, one of the largest producers of animal meat in the world, has been focusing tremendously on the plant-based space, and they have been exploring and investing in replacing their animal feedlots and slaughterhouses with investment in plant protein. So I think the tide is changing, and I think the future's on our side in terms of these food companies being allies.
You make a really good point that, you know, and again, I'm an economist by training, that, you know, it's about money. And so if we, the consumer, demand plants, like, they're not attached to animals because they're attached to animals. It's just what they've been making money on. And so that's certainly encouraging. And again, I think emphasizes the grassroots power we have as individual consumers. They follow us, not the other way around, at least in most circumstances. But I guess maybe a follow-up question to that is, I think there's some people in the movement, and beyond just the plant-based movement, I think kind of in organics and health, they get a little wary when these big companies that don't have the best track record necessarily start buying up the companies that we love. Are there any concerns that you think are valid when all the really great startup plant-based companies get bought by the big corporate giants?
You know, it is a case-by-case basis, and I don't think it's something that can be defined holistically in one broad swoop like that. There are companies that are doing something fantastic and really ensuring that the leadership of those companies and the value of those companies stay intact. And there are others that are looking to leverage the brand power and turn it into something else, or looking to quash competition. I think that's happening less and less. But without a doubt, it can't be wholesale said that every single acquisition will always be well-intentioned and do good. I have two books that I highly recommend that speak to both sides of this conversation that are not directly in the animal alternative or plant-based space, but they really, I think, broaden my thinking about the pros and cons about working with large food companies and acquisitions. One is called Mission in a Bottle, and it's by Seth Goldman, who was first the founder of Honest Tea and sold that company to Coca-Cola and is now the chairman of the board at Beyond Meat. And the other one is... it's called Raising the Bar, and it's by the gentleman who founded Clif Bar. So I highly recommend those two books. They show two different scenarios. One is in which selling a company would have been a disaster, and the other where selling a company could actually be leveraged for even more good than the company could have done on its own.
Interesting. No, that's great recommendations. I have a lot of students interested in this space, and so kind of two case studies like that on the opposite ends of the spectrum, I think that's great. I will put that on my recommended reading list, so thank you for that.
Sure.
So moving on, you know, the plant-based movement is starting to get political power, right? And we have new lobbying groups. We have the Good Food Institute. We have the Plant-Based Association, which I know you're a member. And obviously, this is an amazing thing for someone, you know, like me, who was always on the fringes decades ago, and now, you know, seeing these major lobbying groups and big money come in. And where do you think the angle is on impact on policy at a more, you know, governmental level? Even though this movement's grassroots, there's still a lot of things tilted at a regulatory level against plant-based foods. And I'm just wondering where you think they should leverage that political power, you know, most effectively.
Sure. So I think we're still at the early stages of organizing in that way. It's wonderful that these groups are coming together and starting to bring together the community in a way that we can propose and fight bad policy and support good policy. And it has to happen. The industries that represent the worst of food have been organized and had millions of dollars behind them forever, and even some government money in some cases. And it's high time that we come together and start fighting for what's good. And you're seeing that in organic, you're seeing that in plant-based, and I'm really excited about that change. There has already been some movement that I think has been really positive, even in light of real opposition. One example is last year, the USDA and the FDA did their regular review they do every 5 years of the dietary guidelines for Americans. And during that, they take all this feedback from these scientists and medical experts that are on a panel that they gather of the top scientific minds in the world. And those folks come up with recommendations for what Americans should eat. And then they open it up to public comment. Often that public comment is driven by lobbyists. And then they finally, the USDA and FDA, release the final recommendations. When the scientific panel that put those recommendations together based on the evidence did so, for the first time, we saw very strong language around reducing meat consumption and animal protein consumption, increasing the portion of your plate that was vegetable-based, eliminating altogether or dramatically reducing processed meat consumption, even recommending that dairy alternatives could play a vital role in the milk category, which has been a very hard fight for many years. And these were, and there were areas around sugar and questioning a lot of the consumption of sugar we do. There were major victories in that scientific panel. As usual, unfortunately, during the public comment period, the beef industry, the sugar industry, the dairy industry, all these guys came in and spent lots and lots and lots of money to convince the USDA and the FDA to not take all those recommendations. Even though we lost that fight, and at the end of the day, they did not give us everything we wanted in the final recommendations, which was not unexpected, even though that happened, one thing that was amazing was that for the first time, the letters that came from the public in support of the strong pro-plant-based recommendations were overwhelmingly the majority of those letters that were received by the two governing bodies. And the community, the companies, the public spoke up in unison and said, vegetables, yes, meat, no. No, not as much sugar. You know, dairy is not the be-all end-all of health. In fact, it may be more detrimental than we've ever acknowledged. And we're coming together as a populace and as a industry to finally say, you guys have been shoving down garbage down our throats and justifying the sickening of Americans for decades, and we won't take it anymore. And I think that's a really big victory that we're organizing that way. Going forward, there are real opportunities to start pushing back against some arcane labeling regulations that limit the words that we can use to call anything, policies that subsidize the worst foods in America and don't provide support to those who are doing sustainable and healthy and better products. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. It'll take time, but it starts with organizing, and I'm so proud of the organizations that are doing that and of supporting them.
Excellent. No, super, super inspiring, and glad to see that you feel that these efforts are bearing fruit so quickly. That's you know, these are one of these things I always keep saying. This is the moment we're going to look back on 20 years from now. That was kind of the catalyst inflection point when plant-based is maybe the norm. And it's, you know, things happen quickly. I would have never thought gay marriage would be legal or, you know, marijuana would be legal. And here we are, right? So I think plant-based is next on that list. The last couple questions I just want to leave you with is, you know, first, this podcast is all about social change and empowerment, not just kind of an intellectual discussion. So I want to just ask if some additional recommendations that you have for concerned citizens and both vegan and non-vegan, but who want to help build momentum for this movement. Any suggestions you have for that crowd?
Sure. So I think that the great thing is that it's so easy to make these simple changes in one's life. I highly recommend that people think about how they can try things out, how they can, you know, give it a shot and think about one food that you'd be willing to try, or, you know, think about trying a new vegetable, a new grain that you wouldn't have had before. And maybe you try a veggie burger today. Maybe you decide to make a delicious squash or pasta dish. Every single day you can make tiny little changes. Try a soy milk or almond milk in your coffee. These little steps can make a huge difference, and anybody can do them. So I think that's a really simple way we can all think about how to first approach these things. And Meatless Mondays, other things like that are a great example. I think more often than not, what people find is, first of all, the variety of food that they eat increases dramatically, because instead of thinking my plate is 80% meat and then some tiny little other thing that's an afterthought, suddenly that center of plate can be so many things. It can be squashes, it can be pastas, it can be grains, it can be all kinds of vegetables. It can be, you know, cauliflower steak, for example. It can be all kinds of soups and salads and bowls. Everything that you would have never thought of before that just wasn't, you know, there on your idea list suddenly becomes a whole new meal idea that you can be embracing. So highly recommend people trying it and fall in love with your food all over again. And that's a really exciting thing for anybody to do.
I love it. That's a good tagline. I might have to steal that from you. Fall in love with your food all over again. That's awesome. I'm sure someone's taking it. It's too good. So I, just because you're based in New York, which is the vegan capital of the world, I can't let you go without asking for some of your favorite vegan restaurants.
Oh man, I have so many. I'm really excited. You know, I've been going to the Candle Group, Candle 79, and the cafes since, you know, almost nearly 20 years now, or 15, 20 years. Absolutely a huge fan of them. There's a newer one in Brooklyn from longtime cookbook aficionado, Issa Chandra Moskowitz, called Modern Love, which I think is fantastic. I'm a big fan of all the restaurants founded by a guy named Ravi De Rossi. He was a famous non-vegan restaurateur who has recently converted all of his top restaurants in the world to, or a lot of his restaurants to vegan, and he's doing that with all of his restaurants. You know, Avant Garden and Cienfuegos and Lady Bird, those are some really great places. The nice thing about it is no matter what kind of cuisine you want, no matter what price point or, you know, ambiance you're looking for, you can find delicious food. And that's not just true in New York. It's happening all over the world. And I encourage people to expand their horizons and try it out.
Well, that's great. And I'm very happy that your list of top vegan restaurants in New York highly overlaps with mine. So we're on the same page there. And I can definitely say that those are great, great choices. So, David, I want to respect your time here. It's been really fascinating to get your perspective on this. I will definitely get in touch, and when, you know, when we get some more feedback on your products, I'll get some tasters out there to go for it. And I really think it's just awesome to see, you know, the inspiration and kind of the energy in this movement, and, you know, people like yourself. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview with David. Really interesting momentum in this industry, and just so much cool stuff going on. I was never a huge sushi eater, but I'm really looking forward to trying David's ahimi plant-based tuna, just to check it out. He wanted me to let you all know that you can order that on vestro.com. That is V-E-E-S-T-R-O.com. And check it out. Look for it in stores. And to end this episode, I just want to make another observation here, that the main motivation, I think, for most people switching to plant-based diets, or at least the first motivation, although not for everybody, is definitely this health angle. Right? We know that eating a lot of meat and dairy and eggs, the cholesterol, the saturated fat, the hormones and fish, there's a lot of mercury, that this is, you know, not good for our health, and that we should reduce that. And I think it's really important to just focus for a moment on the fact that we don't have a healthcare industry in the United States. We have a disease management industry. And so when I teach this stuff in economics, I always point out that think about it from a health provider's standpoint. When we have a for-profit health or disease management system, who's the ideal customer, so to speak? And the ideal customer is somebody who is rich, who has a lot of money to spend on health care, and has an ailment or ailments that are chronic and not life-threatening, but last a long time and require lots of drugs and surgery. So think about that. The incentives in the systems. It does not mean that the individuals in the system are, you know, trying to string you out on drugs and surgery, but the system is constructed so that the optimum patient is someone who has a lot of money to spend on treatment and has ailments and diseases that cost lots of money but don't kill them, and so that it can collect this money for decades. And these people do not get any money if you're well, right? If you are well and don't need drugs or surgery, they don't get profit. And then look at it from the insurance side. So there's the health provider's side, and then there's the insurance side. The insurance industry is going to go out of its way to try to minimize the cost that it has to spend on you. And so it's going to try to cut corners and try to make it so that the things you need are going to be hard to get. And it's going to try to give you the cut the corners as much and make as much red tape as possible. Now, you would also think that it's in their interests to make you healthy, right? The insurance don't want to have to spend lots of money on your care. And to that extent, we do see some good signs. We see insurance providers paying for chiropractic or meditation, or even some now health-related issues in on the diet side, where we even see some insurance companies giving lower rates for people who have plant-based foods. But the problem is that since many people change insurance multiple times during their life, things that are going to have payouts decades later, it's not in the incentive for the insurance company of today to pay for those, because that's an upfront cost and they might not get the benefits. And so this is again another reason why the current system we have really doesn't favor wellness and preventative treatment. And so the point being here, my kind of suggested antidote here, is you must take charge of your health. This does not mean that you never go to a doctor or that there aren't things that you're going to need treatment for. Of course there are, and that's part of being human, especially if you live a long life. You're going to have things you need. But I mean in the broader sense, that the system as it's designed in the United States is not there to promote your wellness. It is to have you as a for-profit customer in a disease management system. And so this means that there is nothing more in terms of independence and autonomy that you can do but to take charge of your health. Invest the time to understand what it is you need across the board in all the dimensions of your life to be healthy and well. And I want to also speak to this as a as it as with through the lens of political ideology. This should really appeal to those of a true conservative mindset, right? What I'm proposing here is for people to take charge and be independent and to not be dependent on big pharma and big medical and be a cog in the wheel of a big corporate system. So this is something that should appeal to liberals and conservatives, right? And so to end this episode, my promotion of plant-based diets and plant-based living is through freedom. I want people to do the research, do the work, and make the free, voluntary choices to take control of their health. And that's the message I'm purporting. No one's trying to take anything away from anyone or force anyone to do anything, but the exact opposite, to empower people to make choices for themselves and their family that are going to be good for them, and then ultimately also good for the environment and the animals and people that we share this beautiful planet with. So on that note, I hope you feel empowered from this conversation and are psyched to go and experiment and live a fuller and better life. And with that, please spread this podcast if you enjoy it. Subscribe on Apple Podcast app, iTunes, or Stitcher. The playlist for the songs from all these episodes is on Spotify at DZA Podcast. And with that, have a great week, everybody. Be strong, be well.